What to make of the latest jobs report? Well, that's why we're here. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, the 4th of September. Thank you for joining us. This being the first Friday of the month, we've got the aforementioned jobs report from the Labor Department to chew on. So we're going to start today's show off with the weekly wrap. We've got Lee Gallagher with Fortune and John Carney of the Wall Street Journal joining us from New York today. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, Amy.
All right, so the economy added 173,000 jobs in August, not as many as expected. Lee, take this report apart a little bit for us.
Well, sure. So that number itself was probably a little bit tepid and below expectations, but the unemployment rate dropped to 5.1%, and that's a pretty big deal. And then the other thing is, if you look at the 12-month average, since last fall, we've been averaging 240,000 to 260,000 jobs a month. I mean, that's pretty healthy. So I think overall, it's pretty good.
Also, John, everyone's saying we're going to get a revision from this. We always get August wrong. Why is that?
There's a really big problem that they still can't figure out when it comes to seasonally adjusting the August numbers. There's a lot of people both enter and leave the workforce in August. We have a lot of like people who had summer jobs going back to school, and it somehow throws off the calculation. And you would think that our great and brilliant economists would get around to figuring out how to do it right. They never do.
So, Lee, let's talk a little bit about wages, because there's a little bit of good news in this report after 5 years of pretty lousy wage growth. Are things looking up?
I mean, it's pretty modest good news, if that makes sense. You know, it's up slightly, 2.2% from a year earlier, slightly more than it had been increasing. But we still have a wage problem in the U.S. Absolutely. And I think that's the biggest problem that we have in our economy.
Well, of course, the White House tried to spin it, saying that real wages are up even more because things like gas prices are falling. John, do you buy that?
People will definitely have more spending power because of the combination of a slight increase in wages and the decline in energy prices. I think the real magic number here, though, is the 5.1% unemployment. That is the level that almost everybody agrees is where inflation starts to kick in. So if you go any further below where we are, we should see some pretty strong wage growth. And I expect we will see that throughout the rest of the year.
All right. Well, of course, we've been talking about a possible short-term interest rate hike in September for months now. And here it is, September. The Fed meets in, I guess, less than 2 weeks. So what do you guys think this report will mean for that decision, Lee?
I don't think it makes it any clearer. I think that you could read it either way. It's kind of like a Rorschach test. I do think it's positive, but I think this means there's definitely still going to be a spirited debate. And, you know, there's definitely a case for doing it. I mean, we all know it's going to happen. And I think if you also look at the other very positive economic news that's been coming in, GDP rate revised from the second quarter up 3.7%, and a string of other results we've seen in the past couple weeks that show that the overall economy is in pretty good shape, you know. But then on the other hand, you have the markets, which have been crazy.
Yes, in a word. John, this would be the first short-term increase since 2006. What do you think, now, later this year?
I have no doubt that it will not happen this meeting in September. There's no excuse in this jobs data for them not to raise rates, but I think they're way too nervous about what the markets are telling them about the international global economic situation. And I think they're going to want to wait till things calm down a little bit. And so we're not going to see a rate hike in September. A month ago, I was positive we were going to see a rate hike in September. But like the Fed, you know, I'm data dependent, and we've seen a lot change in August. And so now the Fed, I think, does not hike.
It's been quite a few couple of weeks. Well, thanks so much, guys. Lee Gallagher with Fortune, John Carney of the Wall Street Journal. Have a great Labor Day weekend.
Thanks, Amy. You too.
You too.
On Wall Street today, to cap off another volatile week, the markets were down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As we discussed up top, the unemployment rate is now 5.1%. For some perspective, remember it was 10% when unemployment peaked in late 2009. The current rate, as it happens, is considered to be the sweet spot for unemployment. The Federal Reserve would say we are now at full employment, which we haven't seen since the boom times of the mid-2000s. So what does all that mean, and how come maybe it doesn't feel like it yet? We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to find out.
Let's start with what full employment means. Here's Harvard economist Larry Katz.
There's sort of a balance between employers looking for workers and workers looking for jobs.
Getting to this sweet spot for unemployment should be good for workers, says Gary Bertlis at the Brookings Institution.
Employers have a tough time filling their job vacancies, and they start to bid up wages either to keep their employees from leaving or alternatively to recruit good employees from someone else.
And it's actually what's happening, at least in some industries. Jody Chavez manages offices in California for the staffing and recruitment firm Accounting Principles.
If you're going to make a hiring decision, we need to make it quickly because these candidates are not on the market very long.
Chavez says firms are increasing salaries a little, but
we're not to the point where we're seeing sign-on bonuses or a high demand for increased salaries in order to obtain those employees.
And there's the rub. The fact that employers aren't boosting salaries much now suggests to Larry Katz that there are actually a lot of potential workers waiting in the wings.
My take is even though the unemployment rate looks very low at 5.1%, I don't think we're quite at full employment.
How low can we go? Katz thinks the new sweet spot is probably well into the 4% range, and unemployment will need to stay that low for a while before all the people who dropped out during the Great Recession come back and employers really have to scramble to hire who they need. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
3-year-old Alan Kurdi was buried today in northern Syria, along with his 5-year-old brother and their mother. A picture of the little boy who drowned as his family tried to cross from Turkey to Greece has become a stark symbol of the worsening migrant crisis in Europe. Today, British Prime Minister David Cameron said the UK would take in thousands more Syrian refugees. Meanwhile, the State Department says by the end of October, the US will have taken in about 1,800 since the conflict began in 2011. And pressure is mounting to do more. Gigi Duban reports.
Since the start of the Syrian conflict, the U.S. has been the single largest donor of humanitarian aid, more than $4 billion to date. Eric Davis is a political science professor at Rutgers. He says that's definitely important.
But that's not the long term. That's like putting a Band-Aid on cancer.
Taking in Syrian refugees would do more, but it isn't an easy process, Davis says. He's worked closely with Iraqis seeking asylum. And he says even those that worked as translators for the U.S. military had difficulty. It's expensive, most need a lawyer, and they have to prove they're under threat. Sarah Margon is a Washington director at Human Rights Watch. She says refugee resettlement doesn't happen very quickly.
And part of the problem is that in the wake of 9/11, the system has really ossified and it's, you know, the process is very laden with interviews and security and background checks.
It can take years, she says. The U.S. is under pressure to take in more refugees. So how many would it take to make a difference? Kemal Kirishci is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He had a hard time putting a number on it.
I mean, even 130,000 is only a tiny fraction of the 4.2 million refugees who are mostly in the immediate neighboring countries.
Recently, the State Department said by the end of 2016, it would likely accept up to 8,000 Syrian refugees. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Compared to a few decades ago, people with significant cognitive disabilities are living longer, a lot longer. And while that is clearly good news, services for people with Down syndrome and other disabilities often end when men and women enter their 20s. A new paper out this week from the University of Chicago says those adults and their families lack resources and the long-term financial planning they need. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
For 3 years, the yellow kitchen in Veronica Pollock's suburban Chicago house looked like a demilitarized zone. The Pollocks tossed food into footlockers they hauled into the garage every night, and the fridge, with its magnets and snapshots of the girls, was locked.
We got some playground chain, like you would maybe use to hang a child's swing, and we tied it around the refrigerator and freezer handles.
The Pollocks locked down the kitchen when Veronica's brother Vincent moved in. Vincent has Fragile X syndrome, the most common cause of inherited intellectual disability. And at 5'8", 340 pounds, he had a bad late-night snacking habit.
Which meant that he got up and ate a lot of things that you would not even have considered to be food. Cake mixes, flour.
Vincent came to live with Veronica after their mother died suddenly. Caught without a plan, the entire family found their life turned inside out. Veronica had to leave the workforce, and Vincent, as soon as he left his mother's home and crossed state lines, lost almost all of his social services. This awful situation is playing out more and more as older parents become unable to care for their cognitively impaired children, and as the children age out of services. I'm in an art class at ARC of Philadelphia, an organization that works with the intellectually disabled. Several dozen people crowd around tables. Some draw, others paint, a few smile shyly. Today, some 855,000 intellectually disabled Americans live with a caregiver over 60. Executive Director Tanya Wrigley sees the fallout for her clients as their parents get older.
People who are either ending up homeless or ending up stuck in their homes, people suffer and end up not getting the kind of supports they need to live.
The University of Chicago's Harold Pollock says the rest of us haven't caught up to these new dilemmas that come from aging.
We really have to do a much better job of helping these families, you know, work out the very predictable transition issues they are facing.
This isn't just academic for Pollock. He's also Veronica's husband. After interviews with 40 families, he found people often are stuck on long wait lists for transportation, job training, and housing.
In many states, it turns out it's 6 or 7 years for a spot to get into a residential placement.
Pollock says families need help mapping out the future. One idea, he says, is to automatically enroll a child into a savings account, what's called an ABLE account, at diagnosis. Taxpayers can kick in something modest, say $300 every year, and families can contribute too, tax-free. So by the time a child reaches 21, there's a nest egg for an at-home aide if a parent gets sick, or to hire a lawyer to pilot through a bureaucratic maze. Veronica Pollock certainly would have liked something like that.
I don't think it would have solved every problem, but I think having that kind of money, it would have been very helpful.
Today, the chain's long gone from the Pollock's fridge. Life is calmer. The way Veronica sees it, the country has a contract with her brother to make sure he lives as independently as he can for however long he's around, something he's doing today, thanks to housing and vocational support.
Vincent's skills have grown over the years. He's more expressive, and I think a lot of this is as a result of his living with a group of men who he's friends with.
Vincent might still be waiting for services if he didn't have a nurse for a sister and a health policy professor for a brother-in-law. The Pollocks say they're pretty lucky. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It takes about half a day to get there unless you're Oprah Winfrey or Tom Cruise, who has a private jet who can fly into your house there. It costs a lot of money and everybody waits in line.
That's quite a lot to go through for a film festival. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 272 points, 1.67% to close at 16,102. The NASDAQ dropped 49 points, 1% to finish at 4683. And the S&P 500 declined 29 points, 1.5% to end at 1921. For the rocky week that was, the Dow fell 3.2%, the NASDAQ was off 3%, and the S&P gave back 3.4%. If you're on the road this weekend, gas prices are the lowest they've been in a decade for Labor Day. Falling oil prices, of course, are driving that. General Motors trimmed almost 0.8%. Ford reversed 2%. Ditto for Chevron. ExxonMobil fell 1.8%. Bonds rose, and you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Puerto Rico has more debt than any state besides California and New York, except Puerto Rico isn't a state, it's a territory. So much like the European Union is figuring out how to help Greece, the question is, what can the United States do to help Puerto Rico? That could be an opportunity for presidential candidates to win some votes. At least that's what Hillary Clinton and Marco Rubio seem to be thinking. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
Hillary Clinton says she's there to talk about health care. Nearly half of the island's residents are enrolled in Medicaid, but Puerto Rico has been borrowing to pay for that, too. Rafael Cox Alomar is a law professor at the University of the District of Columbia.
And you're going to end up with 1.4 million beneficiaries of the system with no access to health care.
A lot of residents have family on the mainland in places like Florida and New York. States that hold a lot of weight come primary season. Alomar says Puerto Ricans are used to these visits.
Politicians come and go, and, you know, obviously, you know, one thing is to promise and another thing is to deliver.
Each one is targeting a different audience.
That's Vicente Feliciano. He's an economist and president of Advantage Business Consulting. He says Marco Rubio is going to talk about statehood.
In the case of Rubio, the main thing is the possibility of a status referendum, and that most definitely resonates within the local Republican community.
Official statehood would give the territory more options to restructure its debt. Agencies could file for Chapter 9 bankruptcy, like Detroit did 2 years ago. As a commonwealth, it can't. But whether Puerto Rico becomes a state doesn't really matter to residents like Marita Tesonier. She has 2 graduate degrees and has been unemployed for 3 years.
It is very frustrating for us that we have like an education. We just look for another option, but we don't have them.
I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
While they're busy campaigning, of course, Clinton and Rubio and their fellow presidential contenders are also raising money for their campaigns. Our friends Sam Weiner and Daniel Kibblesmith, authors of How to Win at Everything, are here to provide some tips.
Campaign season is heating up. And any candidate can win. But statistically speaking, the candidate with the most money will win.
Whether you're running for your local school board or president of the best country on earth,
America?
Sure. Here are the tips you'll need to raise a fortune in campaign funds.
The foundation of any political campaign is small donations from ordinary citizens.
These small contributions can really make voters feel involved, which is a crucial illusion for maintaining their support.
It's enough money to be helpful, but not so much money that you'll actually have to keep your promises to them.
Another traditional way to grow your campaign war chest is to enter into a Faustian pact with an eccentric billionaire.
These shadowy puppet masters will open their wallets to you.
And in return,
all they ask is that you totally remake American society in their cartoonishly detached image.
But why harangue one donor at a time when you could pack a banquet hall with hungry, idealistic suckers? Fundraising dinners let you charge $10,000 a plate for $8 of veal.
But what voters are really paying for is the chance to hear you make controversial, off-the-cuff comments, like how 20% of Americans are evil.
Or that Heath Ledger wasn't the best Joker.
Why so serious?
Still need more cash? You can hold a raffle, a bake sale, or the Statue of Liberty hostage.
Finally, guarantee that you raise more money than your opponent the American way, by being born into a wealthy family and groomed to take the power that is your birthright.
Sam Weiner and Daniel Kibblesmith are the authors of the book How to Win at Everything. There's more of their wisdom at marketplace.org. The Telluride Film Festival begins today in Telluride, Colorado. It's become the unofficial kickoff to Oscar season. John Horn has covered the festival for years. He's host of the arts and entertainment show and podcast, The Frame. Kai Rizdahl sat down with John to talk about this year's festival.
There are more film festivals out there than you can shake a stick at. Venice and Sundance and New York. And what makes Telluride special?
Can I use a Wall Street analogy?
If you must.
It's the blind trust, meaning you show up and you have no idea what movies are going to be there. So they don't advertise. Other festivals, you know, a month, couple of weeks ahead of what movies are going to be there. Telluride, you have no idea until you land. So you give them your money and they're going to make their investments for you. They're going to show you their portfolio. Maybe it'll be good, maybe it'll be bad. But you don't go because you're going for a particular film. You go because you want the experience. And the curators, and it's a little precious, but they don't tell anybody anything till you get into Telluride.
So if I'm a big movie distributor, whatever, do I go up there looking to buy films?
Not really. I mean, Sundance, Toronto, Cannes are the big markets.
Yeah.
And most of the films that play at Telluride already have distribution in place. So there's no wheeling and dealing.
Okay.
Those kinds of people don't go there looking for deals.
You mentioned the lineup doesn't come out too far in advance, but it's out now, right?
It is indeed.
So who do you like?
Well, it's a little bit sight unseen, but the big movie is Steve Jobs, which is based on the Walter Isaacson book. It's directed by Danny Boyle, who was at Telluride not that long ago with Slumdog Millionaire, which went on to win Best Picture.
Yep.
There's a movie called Black Mass with Johnny Depp playing everybody's favorite mobster, Whitey Bulger.
Yep.
It's a movie about the women's suffrage movement in England called Suffragette with Meryl Streep. A lot of good movies. And I should say, Telluride has probably the best reputation of showcasing Oscar winners.
Okay, so that gets me to my next question, which is this. How important is, I guess sequencing is the word, sequencing of appearances in film festivals for, oh my God, we got to win an Oscar, all that thing?
Well, half of the year in Hollywood, 6 months, and starting in Telluride, is devoted to Oscar campaigning.
Right.
So that's a multi-million-dollar business. And if a movie doesn't play at Telluride, it's never going to play anywhere. So if you go there with a movie that you think is going to get some Oscar buzz and maybe win an award down the road, you want to get the ball rolling. You want to get the momentum going. And it has happened, I think, six of the last Best Picture winners have either had their world or North American premiere at Telluride. So the curators are very good about picking movies. But it also seems to be that movies that come out of Telluride with a lot of buzz tend to play well with awards voters through the end of the year.
How come Telluride doesn't get a whole lot of buzz among general populace? I mean, I'm reasonably clued in, but I'd never really heard of Telluride. You obviously know about it because you're in the business.
It takes about half a day to get there unless you're Oprah Winfrey or Tom Cruise, who has a private jet who can fly into your house there. It costs a lot of money. It's $800 for the cheapest pass, and everybody waits in line. So you might be in line behind a shoe salesman from Kansas City, and behind you is Francis Ford Coppola. So it's very democratic that way. There are no like super exclusive passes that everybody's sneaking ahead of you in. You don't know what's going to be there, but then once you start seeing the movies, you're going to see what typically is the best of the fall films.
It is a forgiving audience, right? I mean, it's an audience that wants to like whatever it is shown.
A couple of years ago, I was there, and there was a film from Brazil that was shown in the festival, and the distributor sent the wrong print of the film. There are 150 people in this theater, so it's in Portuguese without English subtitles. And the guy running the theater says, we got the wrong print, I'm sorry. And the audience says, we're here, we're going to watch it. In Portuguese, with no English subtitles, two people left. This is an audience that loves movies, even if they're in Portuguese.
It's the Telluride Film Festival up in Telluride, Colorado this weekend. John Horn is the host of The Frame on KPCC here in Los Angeles. Thank you, John.
My pleasure.
This final note to wrap up the week. Turns out stress in the workplace can be just as bad for your health as secondhand smoke. That's according to researchers at Harvard Business School and Stanford University. Job insecurity and long work hours were among the most dangerous stressors for health. And apparently those workplace wellness programs that have been cropping up just aren't cutting it. On the other hand, the stress of not having a job, if you need one, gotta be worse. That's it. That's the show for today. Thanks for sticking with us. The Dow lost 272 points today, 1 2/3%. The NASDAQ dropped 49 points, 1%. And the S&P 500 declined 29 points, 1.5%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Satara Nieves is senior producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Amy Scott. Have a great weekend, everybody, and we'll be back on Monday. This is APM.